Like
I don't understand why you have to dig so deep into it.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to the one and only Mod State Podcast. My friend, how are you?
Good, sir. Thank you for having me back. Still puzzled over, like, we're going to come up with something, some sort of, and like Soul Calibur, the arcade game, had welcome back to the stage of history.
Yeah,
I
feel like we've nailed our closing. Like, if anyone does listen to the end of our podcasts, then you know that we have a fairly signature sign-off that literally was completely organic. I don't think we ever...
It's completely orgasmic. I mean...
Well, it might have been the first time that it happened, but then it happened again and again and just became, you know, but yeah.
Really? It got weird, folks, but we're okay with that.
Yeah, you know, it's 2019. We're good. Well, you know, before we dive into healthcare part two, let me go ahead and just say from all corners of the world, foreign and international rather, and domestic, foreign's got like a negative connotation to it, but international and domestic, we truly appreciate our listenership and those who continue to tune in wherever you are and whatever platform you are listening on. So as always, you know, head over to modstate.com where there's more op-ed and opinion pieces. You can follow us on Twitter and on Instagram as well. So with that, my friend, I understand that you've been busy this last week getting back down to the coast, if you will.
Yeah, back down to the GNO, the greater New Orleans area. It's good to be back.
There's something about getting home that kind of rejuvenates the spirit, but the entire process of getting back is utterly exhausting.
Yeah, it is. I mean, I think... Especially if you've been in the military at any point like we were, it's you begin loathing the process even more.
Well,
I just fire all this extra just crap over years in the military. I swear to God.
Yeah. Well, I will say that moving in the military is far less stressful than having to do it yourself, which I've done over the last this last year. I've moved 1, 2, 3, 4 times. It's like until you settle somewhere that you know you're going to be permanently for a while, you start to accumulate more stuff, but there's definitely a thinning of the material possessions every time you move. Ugh.
This is six since 2016. Yeah. This is a bit much.
You know, I have to laugh, like, you know, we've been moving and moving and moving, and my parents have lived in the same house since like 91. And, you know, I just keep telling them, well, you know, they'll probably realistically just like die in that home in the next 50 years. But, you know, it's like, and they'll never know what it's like to have to just put everything in boxes. I go back home and it's like, oh my gosh, it gives me anxiety, but not that they're
hoarders. It's like a time capsule.
I mean, it is. I mean, we go downstairs and, you know, they've kept, I mean, there's not a ton, but just, you know, little things that we played with as kids. And it's like, what are they still doing here? But, you know, well, we kept them, you know, the grandkids someday. And, you know, I go, well, yeah.
Hint.
Yeah, right. No major hint drops, you know, there. But anyway, so before we get into healthcare part two, if you are listening for the first time or you haven't listened to the last episode of, which would be healthcare part one, I do suggest that you go ahead and listen to that, but you know, if you choose not to and just dive into this one, I don't think you'll be lost. I think we're kind of picking up where we left off. And just to recap,
I may be lost though.
I might be, but you know, the last episode I began the podcast talking a bit about the current system that we have, the sort of difference between free market. And I really mean that in terms of just swiping the credit card for your healthcare, the commercial industry, which would be, you know, employer-based insurance, and then the public option that we have today, which would be Medicare, Medicaid, which you really have to hit a fairly specific category in terms of income to be able to have that. And that is sort of the beginning of the argument of universal healthcare and at least an expanded public option. Now, for those of you who are listening overseas in some westernized countries like Europe and New Zealand and Australia, I believe New Zealand has the public and private option, and then a lot of these other countries just have the public option, and you're probably laughing at us because it's working fairly well for you, but I'm sure a number of you have horror stories as well. So I guess to preface, you know, the continuing debate of healthcare or on healthcare is that, you know, I'm very, it's very obvious to me that there are benefits and then there are probably negative stories, for those of you who do live in societies that have just a straight public option. So I do admit that. And as we drive on in this debate in more broadly in the United States, you know, there will be, we'll be discussing what other countries have in place, and depending on what side of the fence you're on in terms of your sort of political barricade or trench that you find yourself in, you'll either look to the positives overwhelmingly, or you will point to the negatives. So I think the framework for today is to expand upon what we kind of ended our last podcast at, and that was the right of healthcare. Now, I think you brought this up, and we kind of chatted about this precast, and I think maybe it's a good place to start. But the public option is, I believe, possible without actually subscribing it as like a constitutional amendment as a right. And that's where we kind of left off in the last one, and had, I think, a really good debate about the, you know, Bill of Rights and the sort of inalienable rights, if you will, that we have as citizens in the United States. And, you know, I think we'll find ourselves moving away from the healthcare debate to just talk a bit about the framework in terms of founding fathers and the philosophy, et cetera, and then explore a bit of you know, again, what it might look like in the United States and the positives and negatives. Is that a good enough articulated segue?
I think so. I think, you know, when it goes down, which it will, I mean, we'll screw this up some way, but we're going to get the greater point across that the, just because something, maybe Senator Bernie Sanders put it best, that just because our society chooses to embark upon something, I'm paraphrasing here, but doesn't necessarily constitute as a right. He was talking about the right to employment there, which is a completely different conversation. Mm-hmm. But the point is that maybe the founders would have lent a little bit of credence to having, for lack of a better phrase, a public option, more of a federal presence in healthcare and the everyday lives of people without violating some of their own strict viewpoints.
Yeah, and that
was constitutional.
Yeah, and you know, I think we had an interesting conversation, and I think,
I mean, topically based, they would feel differently. I'm sorry, like we discussed.
Yeah, and just to bring that to light, in our sort of non-public conversations prior to coming on these podcasts.
Yeah, I'm sure people are going, wait a minute, how are you an original intent thinker saying this? I know, yeah, it's outrageous.
But it's, you know, I think it's incredibly important to have these conversations surrounding healthcare as we move forward, because
the framers intent crowd is ready to run me out of the room.
But that's a good place to start. And what you hear a lot.
Oh, sure. Yeah, sure. You.
what you hear, and no, because, you know, I brought this up at the end of the last podcast. I mean, we have healthcare is one, mainly because it's relevant, we find a lot of disagreement, but at the end of the day, I think these are the conversations that need to be had, because it's sort of like in basketball. The coach always used to say, in soccer or football, if you will, to a greater extent, you keep pass, you pass, 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 pass. And eventually, if you stick to the fundamentals, you get open, and you're passing the ball, something is going to develop. some sort of opportunity will present itself. And I'm not saying that it's a zero-sum game, that if we continue to have this conversation, I'm gonna hamstring you and put you in a corner. It's that the more we have these conversations, the more we could possibly find middle ground and have an opportunity to develop a framework for something that I think we could find amenable, I suppose.
Well, I think at the very least, we can all agree that the medium, even, I mean, look at a name that 10 years ago you were going, what the hell is BuzzFeed? You know, so I think the media has plenty of an impact, even mm-hmm. lesser extreme ways, of course, on the actual course of policy in this country. As mm-hmm. nutty as it seems, I mean, you wouldn't have convinced people 5 years ago. 5 years ago, no one, I don't care who they are, says that they thought, as we approached the month that Blade Runner actually took place, November 2019, that Donald John Trump would be president of the United States. I'm sorry, it's kind of like in the Back to the Future movie when he tells him, he's like, all right, who's president in 1984? Then he goes, Ronald Reagan. Oh, the actor?
Yeah.
He didn't believe it.
Yeah. And I think you...
These are extraordinary times.
Yeah, and I think you hit on two things, and the one... that I'll start with before we kind of go back to founding fathers is what happens over a period of time and what becomes,
we age.
Yeah, it's very true. But you say,
so well, it was the system. And
you say, so 5 years ago, this conversation would have never happened. And 10 years ago, this conversation wouldn't have happened that we're having today in terms of the relevance of universal healthcare. And I do think to a greater extent that, you know, 2008 happened and everyone was getting back on their feet. 2010, 2012 was looking more promising. But as we hit a time like 2019 or 10 years post the Great Recession, when everyone felt, the tightening of the purse, if you will, that we're finally at a point where we realize that, look, income in terms of wage has not increased in terms of standard of living, in that you're finding it harder to live than you did pre Great Recession, and that's why these conversations become more relevant, because there's no balance, and when you don't have that balance, you begin to have conversations like, how can we possibly make certain things that everyone needs, and I'm not saying a job, but everyone needs, no matter what, it's sort of like time. It's inevitable that someone will need healthcare and will need preventative medicine in order to make sure that their potential illnesses in the future are caught or can be mitigated altogether. And when that is too expensive, these conversations begin. So I think it's interesting when people say this wasn't even a conversation 5 years ago. It's like, well, but look what's happened over 5 years. Look what's happened over 10 years. Why is it that this conversation is happening? And I think that really is a huge part of it, that it becomes harder to live when these basic necessities are too expensive or can absolutely destroy you in terms of your finances. So to kind of segue, we were talking precast about kind of intent, and this sort of piggybacks off the last podcast episode of it being a right. And so often you hear two camps, and one would be that, you know, the Constitution itself is a living and breathing document, and that's why you see the ability to sort of adapt to the times. And then you have the other side of the house, sort of the creator's intent, and more of the Scalia camp, where it's a fixed document that needs no amendment. And depending on which camp you live in, I can almost guarantee with some statistical success that where you would lie in terms of universal healthcare, depending on what ideological camp you sit in. So this is something I've brought up before and probably many times, and people could almost be sick of saying this, is that the reason that healthcare wasn't a debate in 1790 was because there was no such thing as healthcare, and therefore it was never brought up as so. So if the healthcare we had today was the healthcare that they had in 1790, rather 2019 medicine was in 1790, that the conversation may be different. And that leads to the idea of what is the founder's intent. And if you have spent any time, and I don't know if I said this on this podcast or in precast, I'm running together here. if you
don't run together,
try not to. If you spent any time following politics or in the grandstands or in politics itself, you know, you've made the argument at some point of what the founding fathers intended, or you would say something along the lines of the founding fathers would be rolling in their grave, et cetera. And it really is, to anyone that makes the argument, it is really an assumption as to what the founding fathers would have thought. I think you can make better guesses in some cases as to what they absolutely would have thought. And in other cases, it's not as clear. And it almost becomes disingenuous to have that argument as to the intent of the founding fathers. Now, for example,
not one of those, though. Yeah.
What's that?
Healthcare is not necessarily one of those.
No, it is not. And I admit that. But, you know, we can probably make some safe assumptions that things like international intervention is something that we could probably, from historical documents, figure out where the founding fathers, for example, you brought up the point, do you think George Washington would have been cool invading Iraq?
Do you think he would be cool with Citizens United?
Probably not. I think Thomas Jefferson, I think...
He grew weed.
in that case, I think if you're a libertarian and you make the case that the founding fathers would have not been for that type of military intervention,
groovy, man.
You would be pretty damn right. But now we have a conversation groovy about universal health care. And I do think it's hard, and I think it's disingenuous for people out there who subscribe to the intent of the founding fathers and subscribe it to everything. I find that it is a tougher argument.
Ted Cruz.
Yeah, it's a tougher argument for me to swallow, because I think given any time, if we were had the same people in the same time having to frame the nation, I don't think that they would deviate from the creation of democracy.
This is precisely why Jordan Peterson has railed against ideologues, or ideologues if you prefer. People that, regardless of whom the expectation is from, whether it's themselves or from without, or for whatever the reason, having to fit in with a certain ideology to, one way or the other, affect, maintain your pragmatic worldview, how you act, that's problematic.
Mm-hmm. Well, it certainly doesn't allow for flexibility.
Ideology is the real problem, where we have to impress our politics upon the court, and mm-hmm. that defies the express purpose of the framers' intent for the judiciary.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think that being the case, I think there are a lot of really far right leaning people, not libertarians, but far right leaning people that do feel in a way that the judiciary has been sort of hijacked. In some cases, I do agree with them in that regard. But it's sort of the situation that we've created, and
it is.
It certainly is. But. And you bring up the good point about Jordan Peterson and being fixed to ideology. You know, it's.
I mean, he makes a really good point there. I mean, they're not, for that reason, ideological thinkers are inherently untrustworthy.
Well, whether or not they're
trustworthy. He didn't frame it that way, but no. If you get under the nut, Cotton, it's more or less like, you know, they're coming from a certain approach, okay?
Yeah, and
unless you make it palpable to their constituents, for example, the bounce of the ball here, then he can't play ball.
Mm-hmm.
That's where he's, I think, more coming from, is a macro business perspective.
Sure, and I think it does, because if you subscribe so heavily to the ideology, I think you can find yourself in some irrational positions, if you will, where you're trying to make the argument, and eventually a better argument will win. But if you have to fix rigid, if you have to stick with that ideology, I mean, you can look pretty foolish. But, you know, like I said before, I think given the times, given, you know, if we were to put 1790 into 2019, I don't think the original framework, or I think the original framework would still ring true. I think that the nuts and bolts of democracy are salient, and they probably wouldn't have deviated from that. But I think it becomes really difficult to assume what given the new ground and territory that we've created in you know, since 1790, you know, things have changed, and it's hard to assume what the founding fathers would have decided pertinent to create into the sort of foundation of the United States.
I know what Bill Clinton would decide.
What's that?
I mean, think about this. You could have him doing an advert for cosmetic surgery for the Department of Health, you know, where, you know, show your cookie. If life gives you lemons, a simple operation can give you melons.
Oh, God.
You know, I mean, can you just see this just being, it's grand.
Oh, good Lord. Well, this, you know, I don't think, you know, we hit on the point before.
You're welcome.
Yeah, thank you. We discussed a bit of it being right. And so let me concede that there's no way in hell that healthcare becomes a right, that it is written into the Constitution. It is an amendment, like the Second Amendment or like any other amendment. Let's just say that that's just not possible. So the question then is, what would it look like? And what would a universal healthcare or a full public option at this point look like in the United States? And to be honest with you, I find it uneasy. And this isn't necessarily because I want it to be a right, that I'm just trying to find the negative of it not being a right. I'm
confirmation bias.
Exactly. I'm really not trying to have a confirmation bias. I think the things that make me uneasy about it not being instilled as a right is that it really runs the risk of being politicized. And I mean, you find that with Obamacare.
Further?
Well, I think, you know, there's just something about creating the constitutional amendment that really solidifies its legacy, if you will, in the culture. Whereas you find things like Roe v. Wade.
What's indisputable in legal terms.
Exactly. Where you, or even if you had a
Roe
push.
Roe v. Wade has everybody on knife's edge because theoretically it could be overturned.
Exactly.
To change a constitutional amendment, you had to pass another constitutional amendment.
Exactly.
Not an easy
So it's possible that it could happen. However, it's the statistical probability of it happening is far greater than the ability like overturning Roe v. Wade. And I'm not trying to make this an abortion debate, because it's not. It's just it's relevant in terms of the debate that we're having, that yes, there is a difference between it being enshrined in the Constitution and it being something like Roe v. Wade, because you get the right people, even if they're not the majority or the majority populist opinion, could overturn it. And given like a situation like Roe v. Wade today, you get the right people in at the right time, and it becomes far easier statistically to overturn it. And that would be my concern with something like universal healthcare, that it becomes a lot easier to reappropriate those funds. It becomes a lot easier to railroad it. And I just don't think that, you know, that, I mean, all we have to look at, though it is different.
John Roberts isn't going to let it happen.
you look at something like a government shutdown, and it's something that shouldn't happen. And I'm not saying it's analogous, but it goes to show you how you can politicize a topic.
Analogous.
I am making it. But you, it becomes the government itself, or it becomes politicized, and you know, a million plus people suffer because of it. And you know, we can all admit that it's ridiculous to make people suffer in terms of keeping their paycheck away from them. I think it's
well, yeah, it could be you're making them suffer by taking more of it away from them,
or taking their health care away.
Yeah.
So this, of course, is my concern about not making it a right. However, I do believe that there is, and concede that there is, a way forward without doing that. And it's very possible that, and probably more possible than making it a right in a constitutional amendment, it's probably more possible and it that it would become, or universal health care would have its beginnings without it being a constitutional amendment. And so that then asks the question, so then what do we want that to look like? And what do we think is best? And what I'm fairly happy for is that we really, in this case, we aren't necessarily the trailblazer here. I think there's a lot of good case studies throughout the world where there are different systems in place that are successful, even with their negative aspects. And I think one thing you have very much been a proponent of is both a public option and a private option. I mean, it keeps, I guess in a way, it holds on to a bit of liberty, although I think it would be impossible to create a more robust public option without everyone feeling the effects in terms of...
Look.
All right, you go ahead. I've been talking
a lot. I'm going to cut through the fat here with this one, all right? If you think for a second that Xi Jinping has the same level of health care as someone in the greater Chinese serfdom, you're kidding yourself. With a universal health care here, with a public option, the Robert Crafts, the Jerry Jones of the world, the Donald Trumps of the world are never going to have the same level of health care as a little black girl in inner city Detroit or New Orleans, okay? However, I get what you're really narrowing your scope down to is access to. That's your key word. Mm-hmm. I understand that. You know, but everybody needs to prepare themselves. You're not going to have the same level of care. I don't care if you have people on a stipend on universal basic income because we find no better use for them. We don't find them resourceful anymore as a society. It doesn't matter. You're still going to have to deal with, for instance, what do you do with the cost? It's like rural mail delivery. Do you know how cost ineffective that is?
Mm-hmm. Well,
to maintain that. Well, to maintain healthcare services, it means everything is going to be centralized in order to do effectively in a larger metropolis. I'm sorry, the country is too desperate, and desperate with an I, for that to be successful, at least in the short term.
Yeah, and I definitely, you know, a couple points you make there is, yes, my overall point would be the access to care. And I think there would be mass amounts of growing pains in the first, we'll just pretend, hypothetical 10 years of a more robust public option. Because what we would find is that you have everybody who is now ready to have access to specifically preventative medicine. Let's just use that for example. And the reality is that infrastructure is lacking in a lot of urban areas specifically, and even in rural areas. I mean, it definitely...
Specifically in rural areas.
I mean, it let's just pretend... the idea of having a robust preventative medicine system in rural and in urban areas, I mean, benefits across the political spectrum, regardless of where you lie in terms of your ideology. But I foresee, you know, it's the sort of...
There's all kinds of issues there that you're going to have to... You're trying to stupefy me with your homosexualification?
I think
raising my taxes. He done caught the gay.
Yeah, well,
you know, I mean,
so I do foresee you know, in the instant gratification world that we have today, that all of a sudden it, with the robust public option, now everyone has access to this care, but the reality is that it's not there. And that it would be very expensive initially to create infrastructure throughout the United States, urban and rural. If
the president would tweet more about this and clarify it.
That would be helpful, wouldn't it?
He definitely would frame it in a very unique way.
Boy, yeah, he sure would. You know, I foresee a massive amount of expenditure to build up infrastructure, and I think that that once it's in place, however long that takes, then you sort you begin to see a return on your investment in terms of keeping people healthier over a longer period of time. And I think that's where we are today in the current healthcare model, is because we don't have access or even affordable access and just infrastructure access to preventative medicine or to just your daily, your yearly checkup with your doctor, in fostering those relationships. Over time, what happens is you have these people that wind up in your ERs with some fairly devastating chronic illnesses like hypertension or elevated blood pressure that's just been unchecked for years because they could never get to a primary care physician to get them on blood pressure medications or just change habits. So, I mean, beyond just getting to your physician, I mean, there's a massive education push that would need to happen as well. And this all costs money, and I realize that. But I think over time, what you do over time is that you eventually see that return on investment in terms of a healthier population. And this is all theory, of course, but your return on investment is a healthier population and less amount of money going to manage like serious chronic illness. And I think that's sort of the public health vision, if you will, and physicians, nurse practitioners, PAs, nurses within the system that do advocate for a robust public option, is that your return on investment becomes a healthier population. And as opposed to if you don't, I mean, we have the oldest population right now, and will continue to get older over the next, you know, decade or two. And you don't have aging, or rather you don't have aging without health issues. And if you really look at this, like on an economic scale, right? So the reality is what, 65, and I think I'm being conservative here, 65% of the population doesn't have enough money to cover an emergency, or doesn't have $500 in their savings account. I mean, this includes that number includes those people who are coming to retirement age. And I'm not saying that we need to think of retirement as a number, but there becomes a point where I'm not saying like 65 or 68. I'm just saying there becomes a point where if you're a landscaper or you're a construction worker and that's all you know and that's all you've been doing, there becomes a point where you just can't do that job as effectively as you did 10 years ago. And the ability to work and go lateral and find a job that affords the same wages, you now have a population or a bracket in terms of age, amount of people who can't afford healthcare and becomes incredibly expensive.
They will just try harder.
they'll pull themselves up by their bootstraps. You know, there becomes a point where you wind up spending more than you think we would on taking care of these individuals down the road in terms of wealth.
That's besides the constitutional question of would the founders, men like Thomas Jefferson, who again espoused the people, inspiring more fear in the government than the government did in the people, you would have to ask yourself, would these men be okay with considering the notion in the first place, regardless of its intrinsic benefits? Because I'm sure if those men had sat around at length, they could have come up with some government programs that would have been effective.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think
that's what they set out to do.
So really, the kind of debate comes down to, and not really debate, but if I can clarify what you're saying, is I'm talking about, you know, a return on investment. And the next question is, okay,
is that investment legal?
Well, is it legal, and is it in terms of what the founders intended, to have a limited federal government that has more hands off of the or hands out of the average everyday operations of the of American citizens? Like, which, how does the, where's the balance? And my initial thought to that is, so what happens if you keep your hands out of the cookie jar, if you will, you keep your hands out of the everyday dealings in terms of healthcare for the American person, average citizen, what then happens and what is the obligation when that person can no longer take care of themselves because of a chronic illness?
Well, I like to add to that the caveat that the founders also, there's a whole lot of bullshit at play in the system today, and I think I'm being kind there, that would not exist, that's surrounding, that's peripheral issues here to their proxy issues of the healthcare crises, okay? That, for instance, something, as I know that you're like, what the hell does this have to do with? But just work with me here. Something like Citizens United.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you referenced earlier, we talked about the invasion of Iraq, where George Washington supported that. I don't think the founder, they would ask, how in the hell did we get here?
Mm-hmm.
How did you take our words and get to this point? They wouldn't allow the pay for play. There's just brazen corruption mm-hmm. that society tolerates. We wouldn't have gotten to this point where there was crony capitalism.
Yeah. And I think that becomes even, I mean, it's again, for like another podcast episode in itself is where you,
it's not that simple to say, we're going to view this strictly through with the founders' original words. Well, okay. The founders also, some of them owned slaves.
Yeah, exactly.
Where do you take that?
Well, yeah. And it becomes through what lens you are approaching the conversation. So it's almost like making conservatism or republicanism, or we'll just say conservative, because that's
that, when we're Catholic, were they?
I don't know.
Not hardly.
Probably not. But I think it's maybe what we need to do now, you and I think we do it well, but understand when you're having these conversations through what lens you are approaching the conversation. Because just because, I mean, there's capitalism, there's socialism, there's democracy, there's Democrat, and there's Republican. And these are four very different things, but we sometimes lump them together in terms of capitalism and conservatism and socialism and Democrat or something along those lines, when they're really different, but may take pieces from each other's playbook. I don't know if that makes sense or not, but it's... If, you know, obviously, I think there's a great benefit to everyone in across the political spectrum to something like a robust public option. However, if you're looking, sure. If you're looking through it, the lens of like capitalism, then absolutely not. It doesn't benefit you at all.
Well, if we're interviewing Ayn Rand here, then sure, I think she would answer that it's if you can afford it, great. If not, well,
yeah,
great.
It's
talking about this. I feel like through a more pragmatic lens, and that we've got. I mean, I acknowledge. I mean, Nixon. We call it Nixon Care 1 and 2. Richard Nixon wanted not much short of a public or universal health care, rather.
Yeah,
a Democratic-controlled Congress. Jotted down twice, you know.
Yeah.
So I understand. I'm sure there's some folks that are aware of that and say, "Well, you say Nixon Republican." That's more of a trope, folks. I mean, yes, it's a good filter for my worldview, just as RFK is for Mr. Wallen. But I really think Jordan Peterson was onto something. Not to get back on that, but I really think there's something to be said for not being, as much as I hate the phrase nonconformism. Because you're conforming to nonconformism.
Yeah, well, there's a whole philosophical debate behind that, but I see your point. The point is that there is something inherently dangerous, or maybe dangerous is too hard of a word to use. But
no, it is, because look at where our society is.
Yeah.
It is not that far from it's not a few violent it's only a few violent acts if extreme enough to plunge into civil war.
Well, the other thing too, and this is sort of, you know, these healthcare episodes that we're doing, I mean, I think it just takes us into some interesting territory, but you know, there are studies out there, and whether or not you call bullshit on me on this, I think it's even if there wasn't a study, I think that you could admit this a bit that if you are so rigidly aligned in an ideology, that you are more susceptible to, I guess, like sensationalism, or finding things that aren't inherently that aren't inherently
what you got saddled with if you're an old school Republican.
Well, and this is you become susceptible to really the term today is like fake news, because it's something that fits your narrative. If it doesn't, if it's way out there, like aliens and stuff like that, I think everyone, whether they agree with you or not, is going to say, come on, dude. But what you can do is you can find falsities, if that's even a word, that just sort of false narratives that just sort of skirt the truth a bit, that it's hard to figure out whether or not it's actually true or not. But if it fits your narrative, you're going to go for it. And I think we found that with Russian trolls over since 2016, 2017, that have done that very effectively to create division in the United States. And, you know, I think it's funny. If it's funny, if you really go to kind of the Reddits or the social media forums today, what you will find is that individuals that consider themselves sort of centrist are really lampooned. And have really kind of subscribed to this like beta male, beta female, like cuck, if you will. And it makes me laugh. It makes me laugh because what they'll say is that you're just, it's sort of like wishy-washy.
You're a fence straddler.
Exactly. To which I say,
you know me as many things. Do you know me to be a fence straddler?
You are not a fence straddler. I
pick a side and die for it.
But I think, What I find funny is that I think it's very clear to me that anyone that, and I'm not saying you are this at all, because I think you're not, but anyone that subscribes to such a rigid ideology, you can lampoon the centrist all day long, but at the end of the day, you are more susceptible to finding false narratives that fit your narrative and label it truth. And it doesn't mean that. No. To rigid ideologues, you can laugh at me all day. You can call me.
You could turn centrism is an ideology.
100%, but it's a flexible ideology. It's flexible. It means.
Oh my goodness.
I think in terms of, I guess the point is, when it comes down to the topics that we talk about, the conversation that we create around topics like universal healthcare, when things come up or articles come up or information is released, I really view it
new
with
shit has come to light.
New shit has come to light, man. And that
did that I do, ever like occur to you, man?
I do broach every one of these topics with a bit of skepticism in terms of what I know about it. And maybe I have a visceral reaction to it in terms of like how I view it, whether I view it positive or negative.
You do.
But I'm still skeptical, or I feel it necessary to research it.
I give you an A for effort, Nate. Thanks. I think we're framing this up very well.
Well, I think at 45 minutes, people are wondering where the healthcare debate is, but
it's in there. You got to believe.
And I think for the
you got to pull yourselves up as well.
I think for the next conversation will be a bit more structured in terms of public option, private option, and free market system and what they all look like.
Now you're scolding me.
No, I'm not scolding you.
We weren't topical.
We weren't topical.
That's where you were going with that, and your words are very hurtful.
Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't mean that.
No, I guess.
No, but, you know, I think there, as we move through this debate, I hope that, or not debate, I keep saying debate, but...
Well, as we go back to the framers, though, that's very important here, because that's where this is going to end up.
Absolutely. And I think as you go on in this we'll just pretend that 2020 a Democrat wins and they propose this legislation and it's brought to the floor. You will hear these conversations about intent. And if it goes to the Supreme Court, it absolutely will be looked under the lens of intent.
And hey, let me take this moment to say something nice about AOC.
Okay.
Representative Ocasio-Cortez, I give her mad props in the parlance of our times for her performance during Michael Cohen's public testimony. She was the only elected official of any party, and I'd love to hear the argument otherwise, that had any real interest in what Mr. Cohen actually had to say and engaging him in nonpartisan, just what the hell is going on type conversation.
Oh, so you're talking about the Trump golf course.
But, period.
Period.
But getting into a single semantic.
Yeah. I thought for her first go around, she...
Well, no, everybody else was interested in bloviating and waxing, pontificating what they thought was eloquent about their partisan positions that we all knew to begin with. Everybody else wanted to make it a spectacle. And I'm not saying she didn't... I'm sure she picked up on her own topical heroism. But regardless, she was the only person interested in actually seeming to wanting to cull new information out of him. Aside from some smoking gun that obviously wasn't coming.
Mm-hmm. Indeed. Well, let's save this for another podcast episode because I think it's all very interesting.
I'm not saying it again.
Oh, just wait. But anyway, we'll continue on the healthcare debate and another podcast. I think we've had these almost librarian type voices talking very soft with not a lot of banter for 45 minutes. So if you're still awake, thanks for making it to the end of this podcast episode. So as always, my friend, until next time, it's a pleasure.
Au revoir.
We'll see you.